Hello and welcome to Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. This is a special programme for us. It is the 100th edition of Inside Education and it's almost 2 years since we first went on air and we've been with you every week since then. In order to mark our 100th programme, we have a very special guest on the programme this week. It is the Minister for Education and Skills, Ruairí Quinn, who agreed to give us an interview to mark this milestone programme for Inside Education. I recorded the 20-minute interview with the Minister during the week. After we hear from the Minister, Barry Hennessy, who usually brings us the education news on the programme, will offer his analysis of what the Minister had to say. When I spoke to the Minister, I first asked him who or what had most influenced his views on education.
Well, obviously my own personal life experience is a big factor. I think that would be true for most people. But like many people, I came from a household. My father was a businessman. He barely finished his leaving certificate examinations because he was involved in the War of Independence and ended up in jail subsequently. And my mother did her leaving certificate. But we grew up in a household where education was supreme. The commitment to education was the overriding priority in our family. I had and still have 4 brothers and 1 sister. And as far as the boys were concerned, my sister was the eldest. But as far as the boys were concerned, according to my mother, so long as we got our exams and didn't get caught doing whatever else we were doing, we were okay. So that attitude to education and commitment to education is something that I certainly inherited and grew up in. But I think that's very true of an awful lot of families across the country. When you look at the west of Ireland in particular, where small family farms with 5 or 6 children in many cases, living only for one of those children on that farm, and the extraordinary commitment that parents had made in the 30s, 40s and 50s, right up until the present time, when you look at the participation rates in third level from people coming from that part of the world, people, for example, like Pat Rabbit and Eamon Gilmore, classic products of that kind of background. Education was the way off the land and into better employment. So that would be the first factor. I've also been very fortunate. I won a couple of scholarships and was able to travel during one of them to Greece, and I subsequently went back to Greece and studied urban planning and urbanism there. And that opened my eyes to a whole different set of experiences which you wouldn't otherwise get. And I've maintained that interest ever since.
And if we get then closer to home about what education policies in the last, say, 20 years in Ireland do you think have made a real difference to students in Irish schools?
Well, let me predicate that by saying that when I went to UCD in 1964 and studied architecture, it was a very different world. But the international recognition that the School of Architecture had in UCD was predicated on it being recognised by the Royal Institute of British Architects. This was before the European Union, before international standards and all of that. And we were threatened by the visiting professors and examination team with the withdrawal of recognition for the UCD School of Architecture degree. There was 125 students in that small school beside what's now the National Concert Hall. And we were incensed at the prospect that we would lose this international recognition because it had big economic consequences for us. So there was a series of protests and confrontations with the then professor of architecture and ultimately an occupation by the students for 48 hours over the weekend, demanding excellence in academic achievement. And I subsequently ended up on the staff as a part-time teacher there. And we had got a lot of student involvement in the process. And I was acutely aware that you really have to treat young students, whether it's in secondary level or in third level, as equal. Some are more mature than others, some are more experienced than others, but they're on the same kind of journey. And what was absolutely absent in my experience at the time, and I probably was a very pushy, obnoxious kind of young man in a hurry kind of thing, was the hierarchical sort of attitude. We know best, you know, do what we say, we'll tell you how to think, we'll tell you what you should think, and we'll tell you what you can think. I just openly rebelled against that. And until you unlock that kind of potential in your head, until you unlock it within the heads of young people, they're not going to be able to think for themselves. And all that we're hearing from the likes of Chris Horn and many others who's saying that if you want young people to maximise their potential, that you have to liberate them, and you liberate them by teaching them how to think, not what to think.
And teaching how to think, nobody could argue with that, obviously. But I wonder, is that not a luxury, but how would a teacher hearing this, who's working with children maybe who aren't that motivated in terms of their education, education isn't a high priority for them, maybe they don't turn up to school, or when they're there they have other things on their mind, and really thinking, they find it hard to read and write, never mind, you know, getting into critical thinking skills.
That's where my admiration for teachers goes up to the top of the ceiling and the top of the roof of the house. It's very easy to teach people who want to learn. And as I said, I was a part-time teacher in UCD for 10 years. Trying to capture the attention and mobilise the enthusiasm of some people who are bored is very difficult. And I think what teachers need in those circumstances is freedom around the curriculum. Now, at second level, first of all, in primary school, the atmosphere in a primary school, in a good primary school, or virtually in any primary school, is one of enthusiasm. The children are just so happy to be there. As Professor Tom Collins has said, this generation of primary school teachers, and maybe the previous generation in terms of time, have liberated our primary schools. There's a whole generation of older people on this island who went to primary school in fear and dread and hated going. Now you can't keep young kids away from primary school. The same could not be said about secondary school in some sectors, because it's a very narrow, restricted curriculum. And I think one of the things that I want to do is, in implementing the reforms of the junior cycle and subsequently the senior cycle to Leaving Cert, is to give teachers room for manoeuvre in that area. Now, that's a challenge for teachers as well, because teachers are measured on their results, and their results, as far as parents are concerned, is, will my son or daughter get the necessary points in the Leaving Cert? So for that reason, the change in the secondary level curriculum will have to involve a change in the method of assessment and the point system that will reflect the new kind of young person that will emerge from that system.
So if we take that point, what kind of leeway do you think teachers will have in educating students? Because obviously you have your own priorities in terms of literacy and numeracy and so on. And then I'm also wondering about the Irish people have traditionally, with all its faults, liked the idea of an anonymous marking system with regard to an exam. So how do you manage these issues of examining and assessing, and then how much autonomy can teachers have?
This is a very real issue, and I'm very, very conscious of it. And I do respect the concerns that many teachers have, particularly if they're living and working in a reasonably sized provincial town where, you know, there's one or two secondary schools in the town or in the catchment area, and they find themselves sharing the same public spaces, maybe at the checkout and supermarket, and somebody saying, why did you, Mr. Quinn, downgrade or give my daughter such low marks, etc. That is a genuine pressure, and I respect it. But there are ways around it, and we have to start to explore those ways. We have continual assessment and encouragement at primary school level, and we have continuous assessment by lecturers and teachers in the university third level. So, you know, between those two pillars, we've got to find some way of bridging the reluctance that is there at the moment, because international practice suggests that continual assessment for what, let's call it, the secondary or the high school sector is puts a value on the real ability of a teacher who's working with a student for maybe two-thirds of the year to assess what their real ability is, rather than a three-hour test or an oral examination from a stranger coming in to listen to them. I'm not a professional educationalist. I respect the wisdom and the expertise and the knowledge that they have. But between the cultural reluctance to have student assessment by the teachers on the one hand, and the necessity to have a way of evaluating the student in a holistic manner, we're going to have to find a way to move forward.
Isn't one of the problems that with post-primary education that the stakes are so high for the results, because we've a limited number of third level places and we have a lot of students looking for them? And I know you've brought out the you intend to reform the point system, but no matter what, isn't there always going to be a problem there of an over demand for a limited number of third level places? And isn't that what makes post-primary different than primary or third level in terms of the assessment?
Well, first and foremost, the registrars of the colleges, the third level colleges, have captured the Leaving Certificate as one eminent educationist said to me, the point system is a system of crowd control for registers of students coming to third level. What they have done in effect in the CAO, which is effectively owned by the third level colleges, is they've taken the leaving certificate, which actually has a level of gradation, and they've assigned a mathematical value to each level that you achieve. And they've used that mathematical value then to determine who gets into what course and which course. Also, the universities and the other institutions in third level have started now to manipulate that by having, we say, law with French, or law with Spanish, or law with philosophy, and you've got all these different kinds of courses. We really need to start looking at that, because it's come to my attention that, for example, in 21 different third level institutions, there are something like 40 different courses on educational education. So there's a lot of duplication. And one of the things about the Hunt Report has been that we're going to have to start streamlining and getting better value and getting better alignment of courses. There will always be people who want to do X course and they don't get the points, or they don't get the grades, or they don't get this. In some cases, maybe an interview system. I know Bolton Street, for example, to give it its colloquial name, the School of Architecture there, has an entrance examination that consists with a measurement of your exam results, including your leaving certificate, and an interview and an aptitude test. Maybe for certain kinds of high-profile, highly skilled vocational types of courses, we should be looking at the aptitude. For example, we know that the HPAT tests have come in relation to medicine, but the fallout rate for people who do medicine and find in year two or three that they really don't want to be a doctor, but the only reason, or the dominant reason as to why they went into that, and medicine is just one example, engineering, architecture, dentistry, a whole host of them that are high point type things, they find out that they did it because they were able to do it. You know, you're mad, you've got all these points, you could do what you like, you could do X, you could do Y. So it's the outcome of the exam result is determining the vocational choice, if it's a vocational kind of career. I don't think that's the way to go. And in North America, for example, for people who want to do that kind of course, they have a two-tiered system whereby you can do a science, basic science degree with a focus on human medical type oriented science. And you get your science degree after 3 or 4 years. And then at that point in time, and of course you've moved from being 18 years of age to being 22 years of age, and they're very different stages of maturity for both. You then may decide, well, really, medicine is not what I want to do. I want to go off somewhere else. And you haven't lost the 3 years or the 4 years, as will be the case in medicine. So those kinds of things are things that we should look at. But to go back to your first question, and the point I was really trying to make, is the kind of person that we need to come out of our education system at 18 years of age is someone who can think for themselves, who can reason, who can argue, who can articulate, who can present, who can argue a point of view through to a conclusion. And if they meet better arguments, can accept the logic of those better arguments and adjust their conclusions accordingly. That kind of critical thinking has been driven out of the second level curriculum in Ireland, and we have to restore it.
And how do you visualise then, with the junior cert reform that would take place, how do you think a classroom might look different in 3 years' time as a result of the reform that you would like to see taking place?
Well, let me tell you a story about my own experience, because everybody knows where they went to school, but the thing you remember and never forget are the teachers that influenced you. And I came up from a preparatory school and went into third year in Blackrock College, where we were doing the inter-cert because I was in the A stream. And Mr. Grace, who's now sadly passed away, said, open your poetry books at such and such a page. And we all did so. And then we all said, but sir, it's not on the course. And he said, yes, and it's a very good poem, and that's why we're doing it. And then he said, okay, take 10 minutes to write an appreciation. Read it, take it, and then he asked you, me, and somebody else, stand up and read out what's your appreciation, your analysis of it. And then he opened it up to the class of about 30 young 15-year-olds and said, what do you think of that, and what would you do this? And we got into this discourse. It was completely Socratic in this kind of methodology. And we just took off after that kind of engagement. I'm told by Anne Looney and others that if you try to do that today, that the students would react, because you're moving off the course, we want to get the points, etc., even though it's only for the junior cert, which is not a critical exam in terms of outcomes for where you go on. We've got to get somewhere back into that area, and the proposed reforms that the NCCA have for the junior cycle and the junior certificate examination move significantly in that direction, away from 100% of the results of the exam being the determining factor on the outcome for the junior cert, some form of assessment and some form of life skills for a young emerging young adult, effectively at age 15 or soon to be an adult.
Do you think parents are ready for that? Because if you say to parents, you know, we spent most of today's English class or maths class talking and thinking through whatever the subject is, they might actually have expectations that there would be more writing and more more work to see as a result of the lesson. And I'm just wondering, you know, will they base their expectations of education on what their own experience was? And is that a challenge in getting more thinking?
Of course we base our expectations on what our own experience of education has been. And I'm a classic example of it. Here I am, 65 years of age, talking about something that was over 40 years ago. Off the wall at one level, I can hear some of your listeners say. But modern technology has transformed so many ways in which we function and live. At the ASTI conference down in Cork around Easter time, Lord David Putnam, who lives in Ireland, talked about how the education system has failed to mobilise technology on its behalf. And he cited the example that you could take a doctor, a surgeon, in 1911 from a state-of-the-art hospital in London or in Dublin and transfer them to 2011 and put them into an operating theatre. And that professional surgeon would only be equipped to probably sweep the floor. You could take a university lecture from 1911 in Trinity or UCD with chalk in hand and a blackboard behind them and a row of students listening to what she or he would say, and it would have been a he in those days, and drop them 100 years later into a lecture theatre and nobody would notice the difference. Now, I don't think the education system has mobilised, and this is a reflection on all of us involved in education, what the skill of new technology provides. You don't need to learn information anymore and store it in your head once you know where it's actually located. Where they introduce, for example, calculators in mathematical examinations, arithmetic was now basically a function of technology. So it was, you still had to think mathematically in terms of understanding what it was, but you no longer needed to rely on your own arithmetic skills to get the right answer.
Minister, next week you're meeting with some of the textbook publishers to discuss the cost of textbooks. And given that textbooks have such a substantial influence on the curriculum that our children receive, would you consider asking the Department of Education and Skills or the NCCA to take more of an active role in vetting textbooks that are used in our schools?
I'm not so sure that I would adopt the attitude of vetting textbooks. I think we set the curriculum, and I believe it should be the choice of teachers and schools to decide what best books would inform their students in pursuing a curriculum. If we set the curriculum and also set the textbook list, I think that's a bit extreme from my point of view. But what has been brought to my attention and what I have seen, because as I said, I'm the middle of five boys, and I inherited all my school books from my older brothers. The courses, the Latin textbook didn't change, the English poetry book didn't change. Those things didn't change. By the time I got them, they were heavily inscribed with all sorts of musings of one kind or another. But now you have these workbooks, which have inbuilt obsolescence in them. Once they're used, they can never be used again. We used to use copybooks for that kind of thing. You have, and this has been said to me by the VDP and others, that a very marginal change in a textbook, like illustrations change, the content of it remain pretty much the same. We're in a recession. We've lost control of our economic sovereignty. Families simply can't afford that kind of expensive changeover. And we're talking about a couple of hundred euro per year for school books.
But isn't there a problem too with some of the quality of the textbooks, say, particularly with your goal of wanting children to think more? The textbooks rarely say, you know, explain how you got your answer or what do you think of that? The kind of questions in textbooks often don't feed into critical thinking.
Well, that's a matter for professional educationists to provide the kind of aid to discourse and aid to learning But I do think in the area of logic and argument and discussion and persuasion, which used to take place in the English space, English language space in school, or in the history space, or to a certain extent in the geography space, where you could bring to bear argument and reason against a certain set of facts and figures or phenomena, those kind of things have to be properly utilised. In our literacy programme, for example, we have clearly stated, and now after this weekend we'll be publishing it at the end of this month, you know, the geography teacher and the history teacher is as much a teacher of literacy as the English language teacher is. And yet at second level, people have sort of said, no, that's not my responsibility. And the great difference between primary school education, as observed to me by somebody who knows a lot more about these things than I do, is the difference between a primary school teacher is and a secondary school teacher, and I'm sure this will come as trite to the professionals, a primary school teacher is a teacher of the children. A secondary school teacher teaches history or maths or French. And there isn't that holistic relationship with the emerging young adult. And maybe we're going to have to make it possible for secondary school teachers to regain part of that space, because that's where they used to be.
And finally, Minister, how would you like to be remembered for your tenure as Minister for Education?
I would like to be remembered, and less than 100 days into the job, so I don't sound as if this is an obituary, I would like to be remembered as somebody who helped, along with a lot of other people in the education system, to make it fit for purpose for the 21st century.
You're listening to a special 100th Inside Education programme on 103.2 Dublin City FM in the Dublin area and on dublincityfm.ie throughout the world. You can listen back to podcasts of previous programmes at our website, which is insideed.com. You can get in touch with the programme by email by writing to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. We've just been listening to the Minister for Education and Skills, Ruairí Quinn. Here now to respond to the Minister is my colleague on the programme, Barry Hennessy. You're welcome to the programme, Barry.
Hello to you, Sean.
Barry, one of the themes that came across in the Minister's address there was, or in the interview, was that of being a moderniser in Irish education.
It's very difficult to argue with him on this, and I think he's probably on to something of a winner. If we think maybe about the state exams that are going on at the moment, and particularly about the junior cert exams, these are about 20 years old now, and they effectively followed on from the intercert. When they were being designed, the idea was to modernise. In reality, it just became the intercert with two levels. If you look at the exam papers, say, in modern languages, the young people are being asked to write pen pal letters and five straight points in the letter, that kind of thing, which is so at variance with what they do. I don't believe they have pen pals in the conventional sense. They've got loads of Facebook friends. I suspect if they do meet French people on their holidays or whatever, that's the nature of the relationship that they'll have with them. So it's a small example, but he does talk, say, about new technology and about all that that's done. I think the general point here is bringing the curriculum and the syllabus and individual subjects in line with what the young people's lives actually are.
But I think there's even more to it than that, Barry, because, you know, he mentioned, say, Chris Horn there, and, you know, which would be the effect of industry and education, and talked for the need for teachers to treat students as equals. So he seems to be very much for modernising the relationship between teachers and students as well.
And again, one of the things that we reported on recently is the fact that Educate Together has now been formally recognised as a patron body at post-primary. And within the primary sector, their ethos is very much around, if you like, equality, consultation with students, involving students in all aspects of school life. So it's very interesting to hear the Minister talking about his vision for the relationship between parents, between teachers and students, in the light of the patronage decisions that he is making and is going to be making over the years ahead. So certainly a different landscape coming down the tracks, and coming down the tracks very quickly when you think about the expansion in school places that will be required in the next three to 5 years.
He also wants to promote critical thinking among our students, Barry. What do you think are going to be the challenges to making that happen?
Who would oppose this? the notion that our young people will be capable of formulating an argument, following that argument through to its conclusion and conceding when they hear a better one. But there's a problem here. Very often teenagers, they want to fit in with their peers. And it can take the creating of a very particular atmosphere for young people to want to engage in independent thought that might be at variance with the views of others in public. It takes gifted teachers for sure. It takes a very particular setup in the classroom. Certainly in junior cycle, this could be difficult because, as I say, the kid who stands out there, there could be even concerns of bullying and all the rest of it. Again, it's something that's highly laudable, but I think, there is going to have to be a cultural shift here. And the other point is, as a society, those who analyse the problems Irish society has had in recent years have suggested we've fallen victim to groupthink. And if that's the nature of the society that we have built for ourselves and part of the problems that we have, then if we're going to want our young people to engage in critical thinking, we have to be, as a society, ready for the consequences that derive from that. And I've yet to see the evidence, I think, that we are entirely ready for that.
Because you mentioned there, Barry, that we need gifted teachers, but I would argue that, given that most teachers teach in the way they were taught themselves, very few teachers themselves were encouraged to adopt critical thinking stances when they were in school. So it's going to be very hard for them to promote those skills in schools.
There is that for sure. And there is also the fact that traditional teaching styles, let's face it, they can be a reinforcement of discipline and of control in the classroom as well. And there are teachers who will definitely be fearful that if they open up the classroom to more unfettered debate, particularly with class groups that maybe might be a little bit more difficult to control in the conventional sense, those teachers will need some convincing. Certainly.
And finally and briefly, Barry, you probably have more experience of post-primary assessment than I have, but the Minister was suggesting that post-primary assessors could learn from primary and third level experiences.
Right. I'll tell you what I think here. I think the Minister can pretty much do what he wants at junior cycle because it is low stakes and has been for a very long time. I think he is facing a huge battle with Middle Ireland if he wants to tamper with the nature of the Leaving Cert or the point system, for the simple reason that they are trusted. And you alluded to this in the interview. He has to convince people that the system he wants to put in place is as fair or indeed fairer. And he will have a huge battle on his hands in that regard. The junior cycle stuff, I think he can pull off very easily.
Barry, sorry for rushing you there, but thanks very much for that. I'm sure we could spend a lot longer discussing what the Minister had to say.
Thank you, Sean.
And that is indeed it for this special 100th edition of Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. Thanks to this week's guests, the Minister for Education and Skills, Ruairí Quinn, and to my colleague Barry Hennessy with the news. On the occasion of our 100th programme, I also say a special thank you to you, our listeners, who make it all worthwhile. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Please keep listening.